May it please the court. Both parties in the lower court agree this is a case of first impression on how to interpret U.S. Postal Service Notice 296. Respectfully suggest and urge that the lower court simply misapplied the law to this case. The lower court applied the law relating to IRS Form 733, which is very clear that in order to collect or claim against the government, one must have a written contract with specificity. Curiously enough, Form 296 should not and cannot be applied in that manner. Should not because we are in an age of terrorism and there is not time with respect to the posting of a reward for the capture or determination of a person to negotiate with some postal service employee. My client reacted within 5 days of the posting of the notice on the internet, and it's crucial that the matter go forward rapidly. There is no doubt about what the law of 733 is because that has been established in the collection of a reward from the Internal Revenue Service on a information delivered to achieve repayment of taxes with payment of taxes, it's a percentage matter. But if we look at the text of 296, which is at page 54 of the appendix, there are no calibrations in there such as in 733, which gives percentages of amounts. In fact, the requirement to establish a claim under 296 involves a set of criteria in General Provision 2, which cannot have happened at that point. This is an after-the-fact consideration of what was the value. And with respect to the after-the-fact, the court simply refused an apple for an orange. Now, in our case, the appellant provided the information and a whole series of communications with the government and requested that there be discussion. There wasn't. There has never been a negotiation with the government as required. So, but the interesting thing is that 296 works very well if it's properly applied, because 296 is essentially a bifurcated system. Bifurcated in the sense that the amount of the reward is determined after the fact of the resolution of the issue, not different from a regular tort case where the amount of an attorney's fee, when allowed by the court, is determined as a separate independent procedure after the determination of the outcome of the case.
Now, how much do you think your client's entitled to? 2.5.
That is a matter of secondary judgment. My client put his life into this. My client is a philatelist. If he hadn't had that expertise, which is lifetime.
So suppose we were to say we agree with your position and this should go back to the Court of Government. What's the Court of Government supposed to do then?
If you agree with our position, then of course it's up to us to prove the case, to prove that he in fact did provide
it. Put that aside. But suppose the contribution is established. And what's the court supposed to do? How is it supposed to figure out what the right amount is?
Well, that's going to be a very interesting thing. And the question is, has any suggestion been made? What was the offer? Well, the offer was $2.5 million. So you get the question, why should it not be to the amount of the offer? And again, in reward cases...
Wasn't the offer up to?
Yes, it was, but to say that that is nothing and is an illusory matter is poor faith on the part of the government to its citizens. Up to simply means it can be any amount within that range.
Well, the range is between 0 and 2.5 million. If the information that was provided maybe helped a tiny little amount, but really the breakthroughs all came from some other manner, then maybe they'll only get $100. So I mean, that reflects the amount.
That is true if the solving the case was incidental to this service, yes. But if we looked at the Amerifax investigative survey, which was published in February of 2010, the FBI sets forth a whole series of pieces in there as to how they reached the conclusion, which were identical to the information given by my client some time ago. But the hard truth is...
for a federal offense was to figure out what the right amount to award is, since it's between 0 and 2.5 million.
Well, that's going to be the challenge of with reference to any case under 296. And I don't think that element of our process has been developed. Now, if you say Chevron deference, if there's someone who has some expertise, that might be the way to go. That's another issue. Our position here is that the person signing the decision may be
the problem with this, that unless there's a standard that the court can apply, it's an illusory. And so what's the standard?
Well, the standard would have to be determining the causal effect of what information was provided as it reached the conclusion. Now, interestingly enough, again, the FBI spent most of its energy chasing down, trying to find the source of the anthrax powder. And believe it or not, that in and of itself has yet to be accomplished. It's never been totally decided that, yes, that was it. However, it has been decided and ruled upon by the FBI that the information given by the appellant here did, in fact, lead them to Bruce Idens. Determined, as a matter of fact, that Bruce Idens mailed those letters and those envelopes, and the only way that the government was able to discover that was through the contribution of my client. How do you go about that? It's a special expertise. And it's Solomon's judgment there as to how the numbers should be arrived at. I'm not that wise. Let's say 50-50. He's right. But in any event, you cannot say that a person should not, under the Holmes Doctrine, you cannot say someone should not be awarded anything because there's no amount set forth. It will take someone's judgment as to how much that was, and that, of course, would be subject to review. We look to the good faith of our government.
You mentioned that the Bureau determined that it was information from your client that eventually led the Bureau to conclude that it was Dr. Idens who had sent out these envelopes.
Right? That is correct.
What's the basis? How does the Bureau say, the Bureau actually said it was your client?
Yes, it's in the Amtrak investigative survey, which is in the appendix on pages 103 to 110, elements that they set forth. This is how we found the man, and then we put in there the very same information that had been provided to the FBI.
Oh, I see, but I mean, you're deducing that. But
well, yes, deducing that.
But I mean, your client is not mentioned in the...
No, I have to say, I've been at this for quite a while, the government is very much... of the mind not to pay anything. So if there's any way you avoid that, it appears that's what people do. So there are no directs, but when it's the same language and nowhere else to find it or come from, it's a reasonable conclusion that it came from my client, particularly when they're written documents, all of which incidentally were received by the government. I might add that here we have a unilateral contract. We say the posting of a reward notice is an offer. The providing of the information is the acceptance. And that's sufficient for purposes of reaching the conclusion that my client's entitled to be paid. Now, there is an exception to the rule, as I'm sure you're well aware, of arrest and conviction. The fundamental law 296 says that the information must lead to the arrest and conviction of the perpetrator. Here, there was no arrest and conviction. Why? We say because he was resisting arrest, which is one of the conditions down here as to an exception of why you don't have an arrest and conviction. He pulled the ultimate crime of committing suicide to avoid resisting arrest. Now, in the FBI's process, we didn't know that, but the FBI's report, the same investigative survey, says Bruce Simon knew they were coming to get him when he committed suicide. So if that's not resisting arrest in kind of the quintessential way, I don't know what is. It's the ultimate resisting arrest. So we say we qualify under that exception.
All right, Mr. Moore, you want to say the balance?
Yes, sir.
Right. So this is a different case in the sense that we F general provision two, which set forth some standards for determining the award. So the other case is distinguishable in that respect. The question then is whether general provision two provides enough of a standard to make it an obligatory prompt.
That's correct, Your Honor, and general provision two does not provide enough because it still is based on the discretion of the Postal Service. And in this case, based on the letters that Mr. Goldman submitted to the Postal Service that are part of the record, the Postal Service concluded that the information was not sufficient.
So where does it say the discretion of the Postal Service?
It says, I actually didn't know that in the CFR, which the Postal Service is based upon.
Is the CFR in your brief? What does the CFR say?
So 39 CFR section 233.2, which is the basis for poster 296 and all various permutations. And the poster says specifically. The decision as to whether a reward shall be paid and the amount thereof shall solely be within the discretion of the Chief Postal Inspector or his delegate, and the submission of information or claim of reward shall not establish a contractual right to receive any reward.
That language doesn't appear in the reward poster itself. So how is somebody supposed to know that it's a situation that depends on the absolute discretion of the poster?
Well, I mean, the language that Mr. Golding relied upon to obviate our second argument, which is that no one arrested or convicted doesn't apply in the poster itself, and he was able to find that for his claim. So, I mean, the poster makes clear that it's based upon the regulation.
Where does it say that in the poster?
I apologize for speaking here. I believe that it's tied to the.
No.
I think it's not.
If in this case you had arrested the suspect, convicted him, and gone to jail, would Mr. Golding be entitled to any compensation? Because I understand.
Well, it's a good fact, and his complaint is true.
Yes.
Had.
So there should have been a dismissal in that case.
Had Mr. He would not have been entitled to matter of contract law, but my understanding is that if in fact his complaint are true and Mr. Someone had been arrested or convicted, the Postal Service wouldn't have refused to pay merely on the grounds of contract law. But that's not the fact of this case. Again,
I'm not understanding your answer. My question was, if the perpetrator had not died, rather had been arrested, because I really thought that that's what lower court's decision hinged upon, would he then have been entitled to compensation?
I disagree. I think this is the lower court it was not a binding contract, and the secondary plaintiff was not arrested or convicted.
Senator, is your view that the only way there could be a viable contract claim would be to follow, I think the approaches may be alluded to in some of those IRS cases where someone provides information, then they come in and there's a kind of negotiation with the agency, and then the agency agrees to provide a specific dollar amount?
I think that is one way that could be done. The other way is the way that established in the historic case that Mr. Goldman cites, where there is a specific and definite unilateral contract. We don't have that here, but that in those circumstances where bring us John Surratt and we'll give you $10,000. If there was
dead or alive, $500, right?
Yeah, those wildlife cases, Your Honor.
Well, suppose it said, bring us Surratt and we'll give you up to $10,000 depending on your contribution to the
be a unilateral contract.
And so,
there's
no standard that can be specific enough to make it enforceable. I mean, there other than arrest and conviction.
In those, under those facts, it's not sufficient proof.
You're saying that that's the case, if the person brought in Surratt, he would be making an offer.
And the government would accept the offer by taking Surratt. I mean,
yeah, but I'm just changing the fact to say that it's up to $10,000 and that the amount of the reward will depend on the contribution that is made ultimately securing his arrest and conviction. That's not sufficiently specific to enable the report to determine what the amount should be.
I would say it isn't, not if the case law doesn't stand, Your
Honor. Well, except the case law doesn't consider that. I thought you said the cases all are just up to. They don't provide any standard for the amount. Here we have standard for the amount. The question is whether the standard is too vague or too uncertain. But at least we have a standard here, which there wasn't in the earlier cases, right?
That's a fair. If you don't have any further questions, we would ask that you affirm based on the data in our case.
Well, back to the main point. This is a case supposed to be pressing. So what the standard is and how it's going to be handled will have to be developed under the law. Now, we just asked the court to give us the right to go back and present the case and prove the case and achieve justice. Now, the reason that the government says there was no contract is no, there was no contract under IRS Form 733. But there is a contract under 296, just as the court ruled in Wells Fargo, there can be a unilateral contract. The offer was made, the services were rendered, it's arguable as to what the value was, but that's a secondary procedure. This is a bifurcated system, not a single system, and we thank you for your attention.
The applications are submitted and that concludes our discussion.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.